From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made this coming fall when Rochester School No. 41 reopens with mostly new staff and a new name. As Justin Murphy reports for the Democrat and Chronicle today, quote, "If Rochester is the worst school district in New York, Kodak Park School 41 is, by one measure, its worst school. In 2017, fewer than 10% of students at any grade level were proficient in math or English, according to the state test. Most were lower than 5%. As a result, the district has decided to close it and reopen under a new name." End quote. Now, Murphy's story explores the challenges faced by this school of more than 500 students, and it's just one example of the many and massive challenges faced by the district as a whole. And that's why the Democrat and Chronicle is launching a new project this week called Time to Educate. It's funded by parent company Gannett, and it will involve research, community outreach, investigative reporting, and more. I'll read now from the DNC's introduction of this new project today. Quote, "We don't know the total number of students we have pushed in and out of woefully inadequate schools over the years. It is safe to assume, however, that most of them are still with us. After all, when a school district spews out about 3,000 dropouts every 5 years, where else can these uneducated young people go? When a high school diploma does not prepare our young men and women for college or a career, what can they do for the rest of their lives? In a world where rapid change is the norm, a growing part of our community is stuck in place, and in many ways, so are the rest of us. Time to Educate is our answer to that challenge." End quote. So, what can they realistically hope to accomplish? After all, the DNC admits that their own efforts to make change over the years have failed, along with everyone else's, by the way. My guests this hour include Julie Phillips, senior engagement editor for the Democrat and Chronicle, who's taken on a big challenge with this one. Thank you for coming in to explain.
Thanks for having us.
And Justin Murphy, education reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle, as Julie and the team mentioned in their piece today. Justin, the most experienced education reporter in Rochester. Nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Evan.
Julie, this is really ambitious, and I guess I'm going to start by asking you, if this works, what happens?
I think defining success is something that our community is going to have to do. But the goal is to move something in the right direction.
Okay. That's nebulous. That's nebulous.
Well, the whole idea of this project is that it is not the DNC doing it. It is our community doing it. The name Time to Educate isn't just about the children. It's about educating ourselves, educating everyone in our community about the impact this has, not just on the kids, but on our economy and on our suburbs, on our businesses. There's a lot of education that isn't being done that needs to be done, and I'm not talking about the schools. So that's one meaning of Time to Educate. And then the other meaning, obviously, is we have a public education system that is not educating children. And so that's sort of the double meaning of Time to Educate, that, of course, we would like to see the needle moving in the right direction in city schools.
Are you worried about, with the construction of the sentence you just said there, a public education system that's not educating students? Are you worried about offending teachers in the RCSD with that?
I hope I don't, because teachers are clearly part of the solution. And we aren't pointing fingers at anyone, and we do not have predetermined solutions in mind. We are trying to go into this with the goal of giving voice to the community, to really listening to what they think we need, particularly parents and students, whose voice, you know, they're big stakeholders in the education system, but we don't hear from them. And I have a sneaking suspicion that there are some great solutions there.
Okay, so let this hour be the start of that. And I want to, as we go throughout this hour, emphasize Julie's point there. Sometimes there are big community projects, initiatives in which there will be public hearings, but it will feel like there is a preordained outcome, whether it's a big public-private partnership or something. What you're saying is that you don't have a set of solutions in mind, and that you're going to spend 3 months, 6 months, a year, and then in a year you're going to roll out all the solutions you've predetermined?
No, no. This is going to be a moving target, ongoing process, where we are working with an expert advisory panel. It's very difficult in this community to find people who don't have a direct stake or a direct idea or a strong opinion about what should be done. But we're working really hard to put together a group of experts in education and urban education. We also have a group of parents. We're working on connecting with students to kind of explore what the different solutions might be. We, through a grant through Gannett, have funding to travel to other cities around the country. So basically, we're just unearthing different things that appear to be working somewhere, whether it's within our own community in a small way or in Indianapolis, which is, you know, where we have first ventured, to put those solutions out there. You know, what this is what's working somewhere. Is this something that makes sense for us? If that's the case, what are the steps to implement that solution here? What needs to be done to get from here to there? That's how we want to approach it on a rolling basis, not, you know, have some big grand plan at the end of 6 months.
You're right in your piece today that time to educate begins with great questions. You will help us decide what those questions should be. We especially want to hear from parents and students, and we will make sure your voices are as prominent as those belonging to the many other stakeholders in our education system, end quote. Are you willing to make people uncomfortable with this?
I think we will make, I have no doubt that we will make people uncomfortable with this.
I'm talking whether it's school board, city government, or elsewhere. That's part of the deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no solution that's going to make everyone perfectly placated and happy.
Mm-mm.
Okay. Justin Murphy, as you have done your work on these many, many angles of education over the years here, I think I know that you're not here to say there's going to be one single solution that solves this, but does this feel nebulous and a little grandiose, or do you think we can go somewhere with this?
Well, you know, how you define the end of it, I'm not sure that anybody has it in mind that the graduation rate at RCSD will be 95% in 2 years.
Or even 75.
Or even 75, thanks to the efforts of RCSD, of the DNC. But I think that the scope that we're taking is going to lead us to some things that we haven't done before. You know, the two ways to think about it are always... being here in Rochester, we kind of think of ourselves as the center of the universe, as one does anywhere. So we say, well, RCSD is bad because the superintendent stinks, because the mayor stinks, because the school board stinks, because these teachers in Rochester don't care as opposed to those elsewhere. So one way of framing the question is, why is Rochester bad compared to other cities, which it is, as I laid out in the story today. The other question that we need to ask and will be asking is why is education in cities bad? And that obviously gets to race and income and things like that. So I think that one thing that has been important to me and that I have seen so far in my research is, like, for instance, when we go to other places, when I went to Indianapolis, we're not just saying, oh, Indianapolis is great. Here's some things we're going to pluck from them. But we're also seeing the similar challenges that they have and continue to have, because in Indianapolis, they don't see themselves as having been fixed. And when we talk to people and say what our problems are in Rochester, they say, oh, yeah, we have those problems too. So I think that it can be a useful corrective to sometimes a parochial attitude we have that you know, we only have our own little set of circumstances.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yeah, and by the way, in Indianapolis, as you say, they may not think of themselves as fixed, but what are some of the reasons that you might look at them from the Rochester perspective and say they've at least moved it in the direction we'd like to go?
Yeah, so we're going to get into a lot of that in a package that I guess is going to come out next week if I can sit down and write it one of these days.
Julie would probably very much like you to do that.
I might leave early, actually.
Okay.
Just have her back to the office. They have an interesting system called the Innovation Network Schools, and it's essentially a charter school embedded in the district. Through a series of political calculations over the last 10 years, they have elected a very much pro-reform school board and superintendent. They have much more less labor-friendly climate in the state of Indiana than we do here. And they have essentially, there are schools inside Indianapolis Public Schools that are entirely autonomous in terms of staffing, curriculum design, anything at all. They still get some district benefits, though, and they crucially, their test scores go toward the district test scores. So they've raised their graduation rate in the last, I don't know, several years by 5 or 10%. It already was much higher than we have. It was, I think, already at 77%. But so they're pointing to some early results to this kind of phase two of their thing where they're saying proficiency is going up. So when we were there 2 weeks ago, me and a photographer, we really had a chance to poke some of that stuff a little bit. And
okay.
Because, you know, it's sort of an axiom. One of my colleagues, Steve Orr, always likes to say the farther away you travel from you know, your home city, the better things look, because you don't necessarily have the context to say, you know, call bluff on somebody. So we were able to do a pretty good job of, you know, vetting those claims and seeing what deserves bringing back, what deserves thinking about.
Justin Murphy and Julia Phillip from the Democrat and Chronicle are here. And listeners, we're talking about their new initiative that's rolling out today. It's a project that will run for how long, Julie?
We have funding currently for 6 months that will largely funds travel. And we're also bringing on two fellows to beef up the resources. We have two recent college graduates coming on board. And in addition to being, you know, helping with the work, we are really striving to get some Spanish-speaking fellows so that we can really connect with that community as well.
Okay. It's called Time to Educate. And we'd like to hear from you this hour. If you're thinking about, quote-unquote, and I don't want to distill it too much. I'm not sure how I feel about this phrase, but fixing schools or improving Rochester schools or ideas that haven't been tried or steps that must be taken, these are all things that will be digested and considered by not just the Democrat and Chronicle, as Julie has stressed, but what they hope is the entire community. But call us this hour with it, and we'll start right here, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And where will people start to find you with Time to Educate online and have a chance to offer that feedback?
The direct website, we have a new platform that we're using. It's democratandchronicle.com/time-to-educate. A lot of the content, once we fix a few technical glitches, will be online on our main site as well. In fact, I think it is, if you approach it through mobile devices, I'm not sure if our desktop, any minute now, they might be on the desktop as well. But the main site is democratandchronicle.com/time-to-educate.
You need more dashes.
I know.
Okay.
I didn't make it up.
democratandchronicle.com/time-to-educate. And there's going to be lots of ways to offer feedback. I want to start by offering I don't know if it's a challenge to Julie, but at least from my own perspective, having had so many conversations, and I don't sit here with any singular idea. No one's going to come in and say, well, this is what you must do. Do it tomorrow and everything is fixed. Because as many people that Justin's interviewed over the years have said, I believe the principal, the outgoing principal of School 41 in today's story said if they could have done that, they would have done that, right?
Yeah. She said if that were easy, we wouldn't be sitting here talking.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. And so, but you do say, and I give you credit for this, Julie, you say in today's editorial, I think it was an editorial today.
A column,
yep. Fair enough. You do say, quote, our education system is connected to racism and poverty. I applaud you for that, and I think that that's central, and let me get the poverty point. There is this chicken or egg debate about education and poverty. In other words, if there's a lot of poverty in a community, will education be poor, or if education is poor, will it lead to a lot of poverty? I think it's obvious that there's an interconnectivity to it, and there's not a single answer that doesn't have complexity, but I think the weight of the evidence is on the side that says you can't really solve education without dramatically impacting poverty. We have a huge number of kids not only in poverty but in extreme poverty, homelessness, etc. And so I guess my first challenge to you is how can you really, in 6 months or however long this project goes, seek to make massive changes in our educational system that will inspire real change if the poverty rate doesn't change?
Okay. Well, I think rather than looking at it in such a big way, let's take, for instance, the homeless students. Research has shown that homeless students, even after they are not homeless any longer, do very poorly compared to students who have never been homeless. But Rochester, students who are or were homeless do far worse than New York City's students who are or were homeless. So what is New York City doing that we're not? There's poverty all over New York City. These kids are living in their cars, living on relatives' couches, shelters, not knowing where they're going to be the next day, switching schools. But New York City has found something, appears to have found something that's working. So we go look at that and we tweak something here. We do something different here. So I think it's a matter of not trying to do the whole thing all at once, but looking at where we can find solutions that are working to help children. If we just keep the child in front of us at all times and say, what does this child need to succeed in school, that there are going to be answers.
Yeah, and I think that there is a danger if you accept the construction that I offered, which is that poverty is more impactful on this kind of an equation. The danger is sort of giving up, saying, well, we're not going to do anything with schools until we fix poverty, because there can always be, I think, improvements. The question is, can we see marked change? So what you seem to be saying is other communities have similar problems and at least slightly or significantly better outcomes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, this is on our website already. We interviewed David Harris, who is head of the Mind Trust that sort of got the ball rolling in Indianapolis. And there are some very critical differences in what they're doing compared to what we're doing. For instance, the leaders of these innovation schools are go through a very, very rigorous process. So he pointed out, you can give autonomy to a school leader, you can, you know, let them make decisions, but if they're not a good leader to begin with, then it's not going to work. And then they incubate these schools for several years, so that by the time they open their doors, they're in a very strong position to create change for children. So it's things like that. You know, are we putting leaders through the same kind of rigorous process? How could we change the way we prepare the leaders of our schools? So it's looking at it from a very solutions-based approach that isn't trying to say, oh, we're just aiming at the graduation rate. What do we need to do this year to get the graduation rate up? So that's why I think we can make a difference if the community sort of identifies these solutions for the different, many, many different problems that come with poverty and racism.
Let's hear what a couple members of the community have to say right out of the gate here. And I'm going to start with Jamal in Rochester. Go ahead, Jamal. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. This is Jamal Abdullahi. I have four children in Rochester City, went through Rochester City School District. Two of them went through IB, Wilson High School. My third child couldn't go to IB. I also have a younger child who is in first grade. I went through so much with my children throughout the city school district. Right now, for my younger one, I struggle with 11th grade right now. Just it's everyday struggling. And my younger child, I don't know if I stay in the city school district. This is honesty. I don't know if I stay because I did so much. I struggled so much. And I don't think I can go on anymore. I can't explain right here what I went through, what I faced. Through these people who talk about reform, I want to talk to somebody and give them information, and then prevent them from doing such things. I really do. I want to give what I went through to somebody so other people cannot go through.
Jamal, let me interrupt you and just ask you, because I can hear the frustration in your voice. Can you share some of what frustrated you the most with your kids in the Rochester City School District?
One of the things that I so frustrated with is my first child, my younger child, who is in school right now. He was in school 33, as a pre-K. I went to every school expo. I talked to principal and I talked to administrator. and they, I was given the choice to take my son there, and the place is open. But the downtown, the placement center, told me there's no opening. I go to 46, and they say there's opening. So even the administrator sent an email, several emails to downtown. Downtown didn't respond. I went down there physically. I challenged them. I confronted them. It did happen. Eventually, I was so upset. In case something happened, I also applied to Urban Choice. After I couldn't get nowhere, I took my son out of the city school district to Urban Choice, even though I didn't choose it. And then the principal from 46 also called me after a while, after I took baby out. And we talked a lot of issues over it, and she said she understand why make me to do that. Eventually, I wasn't happy, and I went back to principal. I said, she said the baby could be taken back to school if you choose to. So I told, this is my tradition, I'm going to take baby, even though I'm upset. Before I'm upset, when I take this baby out, if you help me, I trust you, I take my baby back. She helped me greatly. I really appreciate. And I take back my baby to 46. We don't have no choice in downtown. That's no one choice. Thing that I can't tell you more and more.
Okay, so
this is why they don't know better than local people. They don't know better than principal. The school is full, they told me, from the placement center, but the school has several openings. They told me, it's full. You're gonna move it.
Jamal, let me jump in for 1 second because I know Justin Murphy has a question.
Yeah, Jamal is somewhat underselling his role. Jamal is the head custodian at Wilson, and this is one of actually my favorite stories that I ever did. You may recall reading in the DNC that he came from Ethiopia, never having been to school, got himself a master's work. While working at Wilson and has had two daughters graduate as valedictorians from Wilson, where he still works as a custodian. I think if I can, Jamal, try to summarize a little bit for you, this is a massive problem in RCSD, and it's essentially people like Jamal, parents and staff who are just full of energy and goodwill and want to help people run into stupid roadblocks in terms of not being able to get through to the right person, having their energy dissipated, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we talk about structural problems, that's in when the superintendent talks about coherence, I think that's what she means, is that when there's a system, for instance, for how you choose your school, it should be essentially comprehensible to parents. It should be easy to participate in. And once you get some kind of decision one way or another, that should be what the decision is. It shouldn't mean I have to go call around to 15 different people 3 times a day to finally get some kind of solution. I think that's what, Jamal, if I can speak for you, I think that's what he's running into. And it's incalculable how much energy of people of goodwill is wasted in that way every single day.
Mm-hmm. And here's another example of where there could be a solution. I went to Buffalo, and there's a parent organizer there. His name is Samuel Radford. He's chair of the District Parent Coordinating Council, and he has been a parent advocate in Buffalo for probably going on 3 decades, I think, but has finally seen some progress in the sense that parents finally feel hope, finally feel like they're being listened to, and finally feel like they can make a change when there's a problem. So I spent a little over an hour with him asking how he got to that point. And they had many, many, you know, superintendents in and out the door, you know, poverty. They have every problem that we had. They were in receivership, the whole district. But what happened is that parents were being reactive to, you know, when something went wrong, they got frustrated. They would go in, they would try to change it, nothing would happen. They would get frustrated again over the next thing, go in, you know, and nothing would happen. You get to the point where you don't get mad anymore. Like, it doesn't move, doesn't go anywhere. So one day they sat down and they said, you know what, let's try being proactive. and come up with a plan. And so they came up with a 14-point plan that they wanted to implement in the district to help parents engage, to help parents navigate the system. And they went to the school board with it, and the board rejected it entirely. So in May of 2011, they boycotted the schools. 62% of parents did not send their children to school. A lot of community partners helped them. The kids got to go to churches and community centers for the day. And after that, people started paying attention because the parents finally felt that they were being proactive. They had a list of demands. It didn't go easy. It's taken years. That was 2011. But we're in 2018, and they have 11 of the 14 items are accomplished, and they're well on their way to the other three. And it's so different now. There's a parent room in every new school that's opening where they have a parent navigator. So the parent comes in, this is my problem. You have someone that's a mediator telling you how to deal with that problem. It's open 24/7 just about so that they can come in at any time and have somebody almost handhold them through discussions with a principal, discussions with a teacher. So there are solutions that are working for even Jamal's problem that we aren't doing yet.
And Jamal wanted to know, how can he continue to communicate his issues either through this project or elsewhere?
We are going to have a lot of opportunities. On the website, there is a feature called Raise Your Hand, where we hope people will go in and ask. We're starting out with just ask us your questions. What do you want Justin and Erica and our fellows to be investigating and answering for you? What are your questions? We will be raising different questions throughout. But in addition, we're going to have many events. We're going to be out in the community. We're setting up our newsroom in different places. So just stay tuned. We're going to try to be, out there very, very often and frequently to talk to parents and talk to other community members.
Jamal, good luck to you. Thank you for taking the time to call the program and air this out here. Beatrice and Webster is next on the phone. Go ahead, Beatrice. Oh, Beatrice, you got to turn the phone. Turn the radio down. I'm going to put Beatrice back on hold. And Beatrice, I'm going to tell you and all future callers to the program, once you're on the line with us, listen through your phone, not through the radio, because there's a delay. And so Beatrice will come back to you in just a moment. Let me get Andrew in Irondequoit next. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for the show, and thanks to Julie and Justin and the whole BNC for taking on this important project. One of the things that I've always, just been really aware of is the disparities, obviously, of, having one of the worst school districts in the country, just a few miles down the road from some of the higher performing ones in the country. And I'm wondering if through the early research, or if this could be a future issue to look at, is how other communities have created more of a sense of shared fate that we're all in this together to engage, the entire community in a process like this.
It's a great question. Justin Murphy?
The short answer is, again, this is one of those things where we're not as unique as we think we are. In general, in the northern, northeastern cities of the United States, this is what it looks like because there were federal policies that made it look like this. And when there was movement in the civil rights era in the 60s and 70s, it was in general court-ordered. And the only – there has been less of that lately, but another place we might go later on is in Hartford, Connecticut, where they had a court order within the last 10 years essentially saying that they needed to desegregate, including the surrounding areas. And they attempted to accomplish that through magnet schools to entice more of the middle-class kids to come into the city. And it was, from what I know of it, a partial success. Those magnet schools were all brand-new buildings, and they're shiny and have all the new science equipment and whatever, and some of them are doing very well. But as often happens in these cases, there's still, the kind of leftover school of everybody who didn't go to the magnet or their parents didn't get into the lottery or whatever it is. And, those kids are doing no better than they ever have before.
So, or worse.
Or worse.
Yeah. And to the point about desegregating schools, Justin, I'm sure you attended some of those Spencerport meetings a couple years ago now where they talked about urban suburban and the amount of vitriol you hear from people who say, I moved to X town for a reason. You can't tell me that I can't move here, that I don't have the freedom of movement, that you can't force kids into this community or out of this community. We have freedom, and that this kind of effort is going to receive vehement pushback if what we saw in Spencerport a couple of years ago is any indication. And I know I'm not trying to paint too broadly with the brush there, because there was plenty of support for urban suburban in Spencerport as well. But that kind of sentiment is out there in a lot of places. And I'm curious to know if you think we would encounter that in any way that might make any change.
And that's why the only time that segregation has happened has been through a court order. I'm aware.
You mean desegregation?
Desegregation, yeah. I'm aware of very few instances where anything else has been the case. In fact, in Indianapolis, this is sort of where I went. In I think 1970 or 71, they combined the city and the county governments into one entity in order to save money on whatever, with the explicit provision that schools were not included. So they continue to have sort of a different setup, but they had essentially unsuccessful mandated busing. It was successful to the extent that it lasted a busing program for the 80s and 90s. It just ended somewhat recently. But, in general, those are things that people only do when a judge threatens them.
Well, except that there are there's growing interest in diversity in our nation right now, I think, particularly among younger people. And I know they're experimenting voluntarily in New York City now on a small basis with starting to desegregate some of the middle schools there. So there's a growing I think there will be solutions on that front, too.
I guess I mean on the metro level.
Right.
In terms
right.
of getting everybody on board.
I agree there. But again, if we don't look at it as trying to solve everything all at once, but looking at pockets of things where desegregation is starting to happen on a voluntary basis is worth looking at.
Andrew, you want to follow up with anything there? Go ahead.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm very much looking forward to what comes out of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. And it's 844-295-TALK. We have got to get our only break, and we will come back to Vicky, Beatrice, and a lot more of your emails, comments, and questions. We'll also hit an important point that the column in the Democrat and Chronicle today introducing this new project called Time to Educate addresses, which is the wall between reporting and opinion and the importance of maintaining that wall, but understanding how this project addresses that issue as well. Because if some of our listeners are thinking, wow, this sounds like an advocacy effort, we'll see what Julie and Justin have to say about that and how they're making sure that distinction remains for their investigative reporters, for their reporters to have those barriers as well. So a lot more to talk about with Julie Phillip and Justin Murphy from the Democrat and Chronicle, and more of your feedback coming up. Coming up in our second hour, a new New York Times report shows that 41% of Americans and 66% of millennials don't know what Auschwitz was. Well, the JCC has a new play called Survivors. They're telling the story of 10 survivors. You're going to meet one of them next hour, Helen Levinson, who had a remarkable story of survival. We'll hear that and learn a lot more next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Time to Educate is the new initiative from the Democrat and Chronicle in the online edition now, today, and Sunday in the print edition. So I know you will enjoy your coffee and open your Democrat and Chronicle Sunday morning, as you always do. And you will see a lot more about this on Sunday morning, but you can see more now online and online at democratandchronicle.com/time-to-educate. And I want to hit, before we jump back to your phone calls, so hang there if you're on the line, I want to clarify an important point here. Some of our listeners are wondering, is this an advocacy effort? Should reporters be involved? And that you address exactly that. I'm going to quote from what you say about the wall that typically exists between the newsroom and the opinion side. You write, "The wall remains in place for Time to Educate, but the two sides are pressed shoulder to shoulder against it. We are aligning our reporting, engagement, and advocacy efforts to move more forcefully toward the same target, find solutions to end educational inequity in our community, and help implement them." End quote. Okay, so that, you know, that does that mean that the barrier doesn't exist as forcefully? The barrier is still there for reporters?
No, the barrier is definitely still there for reporters, and if it were not, I think the reporters would walk out of the room.
Is that right, Justin?
Yeah.
But there's really three buckets to this. There's the journalism piece. And it is different than journalism we have been doing. It's solutions-based. We brought in trainers. We're part of the Solutions Journalism Network, so that the idea is not just to report on the problem, but to report on ways to fix the problem. Put that out there, too. In addition, with the new engagement tools that we have and the outreach that we're going to do, Justin is going to be reporting. He is almost going to be the public's reporter, Erica as well, and the fellows, that we are following up on what we're hearing versus, you know, the ivory tower approach where we think you this is what you need to know. And I think that's a big shift in thinking. The raise your hand feature will really guide where we go with this project. So it's journalism with a twist, but it's still journalism. The same ethics apply. And so that's one bucket. The second bucket is what I call the engagement bucket. That's where there's a little crossover, where I'm getting voices, he's getting voices. We're both working really hard to engage the community around this. And that's I'll probably step into the opinion realm in that way at times. Justin never will. You'll see it with editorials. You'll see it with columns. Again, opinion pieces. Justin won't be writing those. And then the final piece is advocacy. We've been doing advocacy. The editorial board advocates for things all the time in its editorials.
So is it a cop-out for some journalism organizations these days to say, no, we don't do advocacy? I mean, is everybody advocacy these days?
If you're writing an editorial, you're advocating for something. Okay. So we have always been involved in advocacy. But we plan to do more. If some of the solutions require, you know, you want to turn over the school board, we need more reform candidates on the school board, if that's what it takes, then our editorial board and our community partners will work on registering people to vote and telling them how we think that this will help them to vote a certain way. Is Justin going to be part of that? Absolutely not.
Okay. Justin, do you feel pretty comfortable with that description?
Yeah, and, you know, from a nuts and bolts perspective, Julie hasn't been assigning me stories. She hasn't been editing my stories. She doesn't necessarily...
I do read them.
She reads them quietly without giving any editing. I think that the crossover is that we are both listening very intently to the audience in a way that we haven't before. And, you know, to the extent that we hear similar or different things or act similarly or differently on what we hear is where, you know, you could say that there's crossover of some sort. Okay.
And if you look at that end goal, his reporting is to find solutions and show us how we could implement them here. Our goal on the opinion side is to look for solutions and find out how we can implement them and help that happen. So we have the same goal. We're just approaching it in completely different ways.
Okay, let me get back to the phone. Beatrice and Webster, let's try it again. Thanks for calling. Go ahead, Beatrice.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I was wondering how many teachers, as far as black and white teachers, are there in this inner city school district?
It's a great question, and I think we've got the numbers right here in front of us. So, Beatrice, hang there on the line because I want to ask you if you want to follow up at all. But let me give you that raw numbers. Now, this is now going back to 2016, and this is through the reporting. In fact, producer Megan Mack just grabbed this from our Degrees of Diversity series of reports for WXXI News. So this, again, from 2016 from the Rochester City School District. Teacher information, the percentage of teachers in the district, 75.5% white, 15.6% black, 7.5% Hispanic, and then 1.2% Asian, 0.3% Native American. Indian teachers. So I'm assuming Indian means India, because Native American teachers are zero in the district as of 2016. So again, but on sort of the bigger rounder numbers, white teachers 75%, black teachers about 16%, Hispanic 7.5%. Now, how does that compare to the student data? Well, white teachers are 75%, but only 10% of the students are white. Black teachers are 15.6%, but 59% of the students are black. Latino teachers, 7.5%, but 26.5% of the students are Latino. So there is a massive overrepresentation, just by the numbers, of white teachers, and still a significant underrepresentation for students of color. You want to follow that up, Beatrice?
Yes, just a little bit. That could be part of the problem right there, not having enough teachers for the black students. And the other minority people that you just mentioned, they got an overabundance to teach the white kids. And it's just a racism thing. You know, when I was in school, I'm 77 now. When I was in school, the first day I went to school, I was treated like dirt by the teachers. They ignored me. They never would call me when I put my hand up to answer a question or to ask a question. They pretended I wasn't even in the seat there. I mean, it went on and on every day. So finally, I was getting discouraged, you know, like my tears, and, you know, saying to myself, oh, my God, I can't wait to quit school. I mean, to make you feel that way. You know, they don't say anything to let you know they hate you or put you beneath the other kids. It's just the way they don't you compared to how they do treat you. They just plain ignore you, you know, and they don't give you any help. It's terrible.
Well, Beatrice, thank you for the call, and I appreciate the thoughts on this subject. It's something that we at WXXI have focused on reporting on. I know that it's something that Justin Murphy and the Democrat and Chronicle have looked at. And I'll kick it over to Justin while I make a point here. I mean, when you talk to teachers, you will routinely hear one refrain that's important, and I think it is important. We're not going to overnight see a representation that matches for students of color. And it doesn't happen like that in the suburbs. It doesn't happen like that in the city. It's a problem. It's not impossible for white teachers to teach students of color. And cultural competency is important. Caring about crossing boundaries is important. But on the whole, when you see that kind of disparity, you are inevitably going to see some challenges. So I think the core of Beatrice's point is borne out by research. And listeners, again, go back to the Degrees of Diversity series that WXXI News did. There's a lot of research on this, and we still see nothing close to parity, Justin.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, as you mentioned, a devilishly difficult thing for the district. They just presented some data at the school board a few months ago. For months and months, they've been talking about a truly rigorous search they've been doing to get black teachers. They've been going to the historically black colleges. They've been traveling all through the South and whatever else, going to all these fairs. And as a result of it, so far this year, the percentage of black teachers that they've hired has actually decreased compared to previous years. And they think that they're going to make up a little of that before the end of the year. But it's absolutely true. And to the second point about, you know, of course, white teachers can teach students of color. That is another area I wrote about a few weeks ago. They have something called the Victorious Minds Academy, and it's essentially a rigorous professional development program for teachers to teach in, for lack of a better word, with more of a Afrocentric understanding of, you know, not just putting a picture of Rosa Parks on the wall, but understanding how students of color might experience the world differently than they do.
Okay, Julie?
And from another potential solution, the Center for Teen Empowerment, I know that that is a big topic for them this year. They have the youth organizers. And they're looking at, well, how do you get more children, high schoolers from the city school district excited and interested in a teaching career? So in 4 years, 5 years' time, you can get them back. And then one of the other issues that we haven't had to overcome quite as much recently, but whenever there's a layoff, oftentimes those efforts to add to diversity are undermined by the fact that those are the first teachers to go because they were the last to hire it if there's layoffs. So there's a lot of small pieces of this that there might be some solutions there. That if you start looking at that, rather than just throwing up your hands and saying there just aren't enough minority teachers out there.
Beatrice, thank you for the phone call. Let's get Vicki in Rochester next. Go ahead, Vicki.
Hi, Evan. I'm a parent. Next year I'll have a senior and a ninth grader at Wilson High School. Mm-hmm. My kids went to school 12 for elementary, and my daughter was at SOTA for middle school. And I've been an advocate for city schools all this time. Justin knows me. Also volunteered at a number of 15 and 22, so a lot of experience. And I think so many things you've talked about, but the integration issue is huge, the racism. And I think it was Hannah Nicole Jones that, you know, said the only proven way that we've actually at a district level closed achievement gaps is through integration. And so we have to keep looking at ways that we can make that happen. Jamal's conversation about placement was so true for so many people. And that is one of the things that just drives people away from the district, those structural failures that, no clear path. When my daughter wanted to transfer from SOTA to Wilson, it was like, well, how could you want that? And that's, you have to go through the lottery again, or just very complicated and not clear what to do. And it was only through being persistent and having relationships with principals that I could make it happen. I think I've also seen so many different good things start and then wither on the vine. And that's one of the primary things I want to say is, as we identify solutions, we're not going to be able to do them all at once. Unless we can find some magic funding bucket, but I that's not realistic. But what we do have to do is, when we find things that we think are going to make a difference, or that we've tested out and they are making a difference, we need to fully fund them and implement them and measure them and see, are they actually working, and how is it working, and how can we roll it out farther? I think about things like when school 12 became a K-8 school. Other schools had become K-8 schools and knew that it was really difficult. And yet the district put no extra funding, no extra support. And it was a mess.
All right. So
every year we fight for stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's let our guest, Vicki, thank you. And good luck to your kids. And I know you care, and the district is well served, and we've got parents who are interested, invested, caring, taking the time. But one of Vicki's core points here is she's seen ideas rolled out, and then they die in the vine. They're either not funded, they're not continued. Justin?
Yeah, and so we say, I write in the piece that we've tried everything. We tried this, that, and the other thing, but really one of the things that we haven't tried is just sticking with one thing and not doing the next thing. That goes for superintendents, that goes for
How many superintendents do you guys write? 8 in 17 years, something like that?
I think 7 in 16, something like that, which is not atypical.
I think Buffalo had more.
Sure.
Than that.
Yeah. I want to briefly to another thing that Vicki said, that with placement, it's so hard and you need to follow up. That in itself is something that greatly advantages the white middle class parents in the district over others, because they're the ones who know how to work the system. They know that if I call every day for 3 weeks, they'll eventually get sick of me and let my kid into SOTA or school 23 or whatever it is. As we talk about the intersection of race and class, that is part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we're making parent engagement so important, because parents do have a hard time being engaged in their schools for a variety of different reasons. So if we can help lend them the voice that they don't have right now, that would be huge, I think.
All right. Before we lose the hour here, if you've just been tuning in toward the tail end of it here, the reason our guests are here, Julie Phillip and Justin Murphy, is that the Democrat and Chronicle has launched Time to Educate, which is going to be at least a six-month project funded in large part by Gannett, the parent company, and they're going to be doing it in multiple prongs, and they're going to be trying to reach out to all parts of our community to figure out how to change and eliminate inequity in the public school system, in Rochester in particular, and we've got big, big problems to solve here. Julie and Justin have been letting us know some basics as we kind of take a look at the outline of it. And Justin, I wanted to spend more time with it, but why don't we take the last couple of minutes? I think your story on School 41 that's out today is a good example of a school it's closing. It's going to reopen in the fall under a new name, probably mostly new staff. But that was a school that, more than 500 students. And Justin walked in and I said, boy, that was an extreme case. And you said, boy, the numbers of that school aren't that far off the district averages, the poverty, free and reduced lunches, and everything else.
Yeah. And the way you diagnose what happened at School 41 is sort of a litmus test for a lot of things about the district. On one hand, what the state will tell you, and they're not wrong, is that there are, out of whatever it was, 500 kids in that school, 450 of them don't know as much math as they ought to. or can't read as well as they ought to. And that's a, or more than that maybe, that's a massive problem. But so an interesting thing about School 41 is they're closing in, I don't know, 2 weeks. That'll be the end of it. The Saturday before they close, they're having a massive party and festival with all of the kids. It's a big celebration. They're having bounce houses and putting in a time capsule. And it seems incongruous. Like, you know, why when a school is dying would it have anything to celebrate? But a lot of the parents and the staff and the kids there feel like they've done what they could in challenging circumstances, and they've made gains. You know, their suspension rate plummeted over the last few years, and to a certain extent, it's a matter of happenstance that they are the ones that got closed and not any other school in those circumstances.
I think you got to read Justin's story on School 41, because the easy thing to do right out of the gate is see those opening stats and say, it's a failure, nobody cared, you know, disaster, parents don't care, students mm-hmm. don't care, the teachers don't care, the principal. It's not the case. And it doesn't mean that it should have gone on the way it was in perpetuity, but it shows the complexity and the challenge of the problem. And that's why I said to Julie Phillip earlier, my concern is the poverty and how just intractable that poverty may be to finding solutions. But you're on the case, and there's a lot to learn. There's a lot to learn here in other cities like Indianapolis and perhaps other districts. Online now, democratandchronicle.com/time-2-educate. Going to be a busy 6 months, I suspect.
I think it might be.
Come back in December, end of the year.
Absolutely.
We'll see how it's going.
Okay.
And, of course, you can read Julie and her team's work on the opinion side. Justin Murphy's work on a near daily basis is one of the most important pieces of regular journalism in this community. Thanks for still being there and doing it.
Thank you, Evan.
We always appreciate when newspapers are still here, still doing it. That's the Democrat and Chronicle. Justin, Julie, time to educate. More connections coming up.